Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, it's episode 152, and I am joined for a Journal Club episode by Dr. Daniel Chow of the University of California, San Diego, and Dr. Shriji Patel of Vanderbilt University. We discussed three recent articles in JAMA Ophthalmology regarding drug prices in the U.S. and Australia, SCORE 2 study results secondary analysis, and statins and diabetic retinopathy. All articles can be found in the episode description with links. A list of financial disclosures are attached to this episode in the episode description. None of these disclosures had any influence on the following discussion. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two retina specialists. First, in alphabetic order, back on the show, Dr. Daniel Chow from the University of California, San Diego. Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Jay. Great to be here.
And first time on the show, a new guest, Dr. Shriji Patel from Vanderbilt University. Shriji, welcome.
Thanks, Jay. Happy to be here.
So this is one of our Journal Club episodes. Like our other Journal Club episodes, we will put the articles in the episode description if you'd like to read the articles. And what we're going to do is go through some of the recent articles in big journals. And all the three of these articles came from JAMA Ophthalmology within the last month or so. And the first article we're going to talk about is called Comparison of Ophthalmic Medication Prices Between the United States and Australia. This was published online January 10, 2019 by Ravi Parikh et al., including Dr. Yasha Modi, as the senior author, one of the frequent correspondents on this show. Dan, you want to tell us a little bit about what the authors sought to show and what the results were of this paper?
Yeah, so I think this was a very timely article, especially with the discussion about drug prices in general. And so I think what this group wanted to look at is to understand, first, how ophthalmic medication prices differ for certain medications. Particularly want to look at the United States and Australia. And why is that? Well, in terms of these two countries, they're most similar from an insurance standpoint in that they are a fee-for-service. In general, that's the primary way of reimbursement versus other countries like Britain. They might be like a government system. And also, it just in terms of, I think, similarities in terms of prevalence of ophthalmic diseases and such, they felt that Australia was a good comparator to do this particular type of study. And so what they decided to look at were three medications, adalimumab, which is used to treat uveitis for those that aren't aware, and also ranibizumab and aflibercept. And the reason for choosing these is that, these I believe are among the highest costing ophthalmic drugs for both the United States and Australia, and also among, I think, all healthcare. And so what they did is they looked at for the U.S. Medicare Part B spending, which is medications that are administered by a physician, and looked at the prices using some publicly available databases. And there was a similar type of database in Australia to look at this. So they looked at the price of these three drugs over the time period of 2013 to 2017. And what they found was that, at least for the United States, for adalimumab, in the United States, it was about $1,000 versus Australia was $1,800. But interesting enough, those things switched in 2017, where the United States price was about $1,800 and Australia was about $1,200. So just to summarize, the Australian price for adalimumab was actually higher in 2013 by about 20%, but then ended up being about, I think, about 60% lower in 2017. And they did the same thing for ranibizumab and aflibercept. And I won't say the exact numbers, but essentially the prices for both aflibercept as well as ranibizumab was about, they were about the same in 2013, both about $2,000. And in 2017 in Australia, both ranibizumab and aflibercept were half the price, about $1,000 compared to about $1,900 in the United States. And so that was kind of the big summary that indeed between these two countries, which have somewhat similar, healthcare and reimbursement systems, the drugs in the United States still ended up being much more expensive.
A lot to take home, Daniel. Great job summarizing that. And the discussion actually is pretty small for this paper. I think it was a very, very well-written, succinct paper, and discussion just kind of mentioned, that it's hard to know why this happened, to assess why with a further study, perhaps. Shriji, just your reactions to this and what you think it indicates regarding drug pricing here in the United States.
Yeah, so again, I agree. Dan gave a great summary, and this really is a timely article. The authors did a great job summarizing the numbers and adjusting it for inflation. I think the benefit of a paper like this is it really is useful for sparking discussion. And sometimes a topic like this can be very amorphous and undefined, and they really do assign numbers and quantify the differences that we're seeing between two higher income countries that have similar healthcare infrastructures. And so I think they do a great job of laying a foundation for us to discuss this. And in doing so, I actually looked up a little bit more about the PBS, which is the Australian corollary to Medicare. And one of the things I noted is, they do have the ability to negotiate drug prices. And that's actually been a big topic of conversation under, the recent climate in America about Medicare's inability to do so and whether that's affecting our ability to competitively price these medications. The secondary, obviously, the strain on the economy. And so I think this paper is very timely and important in terms of us getting an idea of just how much these differences are in medications that we're clearly going to be using quite a bit of moving forward. Ranibizumab and aflibercept are two of the top five Medicare Part B medications that we use in terms of total cost to the country. And so it really is something that's very germane to ophthalmology practice moving forward.
Yeah, just a comment on this, and I think Shriji brought up a great point. And the key question is that comes out is, why are the prices so different? And notably in this paper, there's a very short discussion. And those of you who know Dr. Yashimoti, who I think definitely commend both he and Ravi Parikh for an excellent paper. He's not known to be particularly terse and precise, short with his discussions, and it turns out I had a discussion where they had a lot to say about it, and I think Shriji is exactly right. The main reason is that the Australian government has the ability to negotiate the price of the drug versus the CMS does not. Essentially, the drug company proposes the price, and then CMS can either agree to accept it or not, and that's actually different from potentially other insurance, either other private insurers or the VA, in which there may be room to negotiate. So I think just want to commend them on this great and timely paper. I just also wanted to say, as I heard, that Ravi Parikh is currently a medical retina fellow at Mass Eye and Ears, actually looking for a job in the Northeast area. So if any of you guys have any leads, please feel free to contact him.
I'll add that to your list of disclosures for the podcast, Dan.
That's right.
Well, let's move on to this other article. So this was the month 12 outcomes after treatment change at month 6 among poor responders to aflibercept or bevacizumab in eyes with macular edema secondary to central or hemiretinal vein occlusion. This was a secondary analysis of the SCORE 2 study, which we talked about maybe the 6-month results maybe a year and a half ago, Dan, maybe right after ARVO, maybe almost 2 years now. But this was published online December 27, 2018 by Ip et al. And so, Shriji, just want to tell us a little bit about what they tried to do in this analysis and what they showed?
Sure. So essentially, looking at the SCORE 2 data, they really wanted to isolate patients that they deemed were poor responders to their initial treatment therapy at 6 months, and then seeing how a predefined switch in their therapy resulted in changes in their visual acuity letter score or changes in their CST. Central subfield thickness. They defined these poor responders as people that had suboptimal visual outcomes, essentially visual acuity letter score of 58 letters or less, which they said was approximately a 20 over 80 Snellen, or less than 5 letters of improvement from baseline, and that they had suboptimal CSTs. And basically, it was anyone above 320 microns or with persistent intraretinal or subretinal fluid. And so in total, they had 49 of these patients that they deemed the poor responders, 14 in the initial aflibercept group and 35 in the initial bevacizumab group. The aflibercept group was predefined to receive a dexamethasone implant injection at month 7 and then had the option of receiving another one a few months out. I'm on six. And then the bevacizumab group, basically, they could switch to monthly aflibercept for month 6, 7, 8, followed by a treatment extend regimen. And what they found was, you know, the aflibercept group, you know, there's only 14 patients, so the sample size is a little bit difficult to apply these results. But they found that the dexamethasone implant didn't really alter the visual acuity letter score much. In contrast, the patients that had bevacizumab for the first half of the year and then switched to aflibercept, they noticed a significant improvement in visual acuity letter score, approximately 10 letters, and 125 micron improvement in CST. And so essentially, you know, and the authors are very good, you know, they're very open about the fact that it's difficult to apply these results broadly because the sample size is small. But they do say that, you know, in patients that you start with, let's say, bevacizumab for CME in an HRVO or CRVO situation, and if they have what you deem an incomplete response, switching to aflibercept may be a reasonable option.
That's really well put. Dan, your reactions to this paper and the analysis?
Yeah, I would say, just I think what Shriju said, I don't think the results are completely surprising. I definitely commend the score too. Obviously a great group, and they really thought ahead to make this a pre-planned secondary analysis and not a post hoc secondary analysis. And you just kind of think from a clinical practice standpoint, wow, like if a patient still has fluid and for a CRVO or a BRVO after 6 monthly injections of aflibercept, you know, that's probably a pretty refractory CRVO. And so, you know, switching to Ozurdex at that point, or I'm sorry, the dexamethasone implant, I guess it's not completely surprising that it doesn't make a difference. I thought conversely, it was interesting that after 6 monthly injections of bevacizumab, that if you switch them to aflibercept, you actually got what seemed to be like a fairly significant visual acuity change and also improvement in fluid. And I think, again, as the authors state, there really needs to be larger studies to really replicate that fact. And they mentioned actually this great study, this simulated switch study that from Rick Ferris, in which they essentially did some studies of the CAT study, and they kind of picked random points and said, like, okay, if they switched, you know, what would people do? And basically there's a lot of regression to the mean, and, you know, and it's very hard to tell whether switching of a medication actually really has an effect. You really need very, very large numbers to be able to prove that.
So, again, like you said, this may not be that surprising to us. I would say the only thing, again, it's interesting the way it was designed, where aflibercept was the rescue for bevacizumab, but a steroid was the rescue for aflibercept. And I think it's a small sample, but we've seen with, anecdotally, I think maybe we've all seen that there are patients that may respond better to off-label bevacizumab than to an on-label drug, just because maybe in some individual variation. You know, the other thing that I thought was interesting study design, and I guess the other interesting thing to think about is the dexamethasone switch didn't seem to help much. This is for RVO. We've talked about it with protocol U for DME, for example, where you don't necessarily have an improvement in visual acuity when you do that switch. But again, it's a very small sample size. I just don't know. I mean, does this change, for example, Shriji, how you think about steroids for RVO at all?
You know, it's an interesting point. One of the things I looked at, they talked about the central subfield thickness in these patients, and they all started, these poor responders, initially before they started in their initial treatment regimen, they all started with above 650 in terms of their central subfield thickness. The aflibercept poor responders, even though they didn't experience the visual acuity letter score gains that were deemed significant, they lost about 400 microns in terms of their average central subfield thickness by month 6. Versus bevacizumab, you know, those patients that were the poor responders in that group, they still had about 400, 415 microns worth of thickness of fluid in their maculas when they were deemed poor responders. So, you know, kind of getting to your question, you know, we know that aflibercept can be really good at drying the macula, but, you know, CRVOs, HRVOs, these are devastating ischemic events, and there probably is more to it than just drying the macula. And that may be a little bit of a window into why the steroids, which are also obviously very good at drying the macula, didn't really make much of a hit on the visual acuity letter score.
Right, because maybe we're pre-selecting out the eyes where we got rid of the Mac the Redeemer, but the vision didn't really
exactly
budge.
Right. One of the things for me, I bias myself towards anti-VEGF agents in RVOs, if only because not only is it helping with the macular edema, but any secondary complications from these types of ischemic events, including neovascularization in the posterior and anterior segment. So I still lean on anti-VEGFs quite a bit, but I'm not averse to using steroids in conjunction, especially for these resistant cases where I do feel that there is vision kind of left on the table that we can get with resolution of fluid.
Dan, thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think I completely agree with that. I think this is really where things like the IRIS registry could be really helpful in helping to have, you know, much larger numbers to really tease out some of these switching things or whether there's a difference between aflibercept, bevacizumab, steroids for CRVO or for any of these diseases.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that the other interesting thing is just to think back to the SCORE 2 6 months results, right, where bevacizumab and aflibercept, not huge visual acuity differences between the two groups, but maybe, you know, the better anatomic effect of the aflibercept. Again, maybe a strategy that ties into what we're seeing here, right, is that maybe the aflibercept is better at drying, but there's enough patients where ischemia or something else is driving the poor vision that it's hard to tease out visual acuity differences between the groups, even if one agent is quote-unquote better at treating what we're trying to treat, which is the macular edema.
Yeah, and I think, we see with these anti-VEGF agents that one may be better at drying, but we're also seeing, as we accumulate more and more high-quality data, you know, that drying is not the end-all be-all. There is a lot else to do, you know, disorganization of the layers, ischemia, enlargement of FAV, a lot of other things play a role in terms of visual acuity. And so we'll see quite a bit where, you know, one agent is better at drying, typically aflibercept, but it doesn't necessarily compute in terms of visual acuity letter scores. And so I think that's another thing that's important to keep in mind, you know, drying the macula, these are easy endpoints for us because we have agents that do it and do it well. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to make the vision better, because a lot of these diseases, like you said, Jay, are multifactorial, and there's more to it than just what we see on the OCT.
Well, moving to our last paper, it's Association of Statin Therapy with Prevention of Vision-Threatening Diabetic Retinopathy. This is from January 10, 2019, by Kang et al. Sunir Garg was the third author in this paper, and the senior author, Yushu Wang. This was published in JAMA Ophthalmology, and I'll just run through it and then we can discuss. So basically, they were looking at seeing in a cohort study of over 35,000 patients in Taiwan with type 2 diabetes and dyslipidemia, you know, what was the association of statins with diabetic retinopathy? And what they found was that patients taking statins did have lower rates of diabetic retinopathy. And, you know, again, this was done over a long period, 15 years they looked at patients. And they basically also excluded patients who were getting other lipid-lowering medications to maybe take a confounder such as fibrates, for example, which, you know, Craig Grebman came on the podcast a little bit about. Fibrates may also be protective. Fenofibrate and other of the medication in the class may be protective against diabetic retinopathy. And again, what was interesting is that they not only had lower rates of diabetic retinopathy, they had lower rates of both types of diabetic retinopathy and complications of diabetic retinopathy, such as vitreous hemorrhage, tractional detachment, and macular edema. And as a result, less treatment interventions, including laser and surgery. They also had less cardiovascular events, diabetic retinopathy, and foot ulcers as well. And so this was a cohort study, but basically there were good associations with statin therapy and decreased risk of diabetic retinopathy and treatment for it. Dan, I'll let you start. You know, obviously this type of analysis is limited because it is not interventional. It is just reporting data that is available in a patient database, for example. It's correlation, not causation. But what do you kind of take from this study, and are you going to apply anything to your patients?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. So I think this is where I kind of going back to the point of like, okay, what can we do with big data? What kind of studies can we do? And I thought this was a really interesting and well done study to look at this very, you know, controversial issue of whether statins prevent progression of diabetic retinopathy. And I have to commend the authors for a very good study design. They put a lot of thought into terms of trying to control all of the various covariates that are involved, They also had very long follow-up, so up to 7 years follow-up. And so especially with patients with diabetic retinopathy, you know, who may, like, especially if you get patients without diabetic retinopathy, they were actually able to catch and look at how many patients without diabetic retinopathy when they started ended up then getting some sort of diabetic retinopathy over the 7 year period. And you really need something like in the 5 to 10 year period to be able to try and track that. And so I thought that was like very impressive. And, you know, one thing I should mention is that a lot of it is based on like claims and diagnoses. And so, you know, there's kind of inherent limitations to that. But I thought in terms of the number of things that they looked at, so for instance, you know, things that are incontrovertible, like whether they received a procedure like retinal laser, intravitreal injection, or vitrectomy, those are things that are clearly documented within within this database. And those showed very strong trends for the statin group having less of those events than the non-statin groups. And then also these other things like kind of first diagnosis of diabetic retinopathy, other types of adverse events. And so the data in aggregate in terms of the association looks quite convincing to me, given the large number of patients and such. So I definitely think it's a very well-designed study. In terms of whether I'm willing to now like put all my patients on a statin with diabetic retinopathy, I think I'm still not quite there yet. I think this is a very well-done study, but I would like to see kind of additional data that really suggest this. Like, as you guys know, statins are not completely benign, and probably a lot of patients who are already at risk for diabetic retinopathy probably already also have, you know, dyslipidemia as a comorbidity as well. But it's definitely something intriguing. I think definitely it would be difficult to do like a prospective study because you'd have to do it over, or maybe it is possible in, you know, probably like a year or two timeline and look at, it would have to be structured very similar to kind of like the Panorama or other trials looking at progression of diabetic retinopathy to look to see what the effect of statins are. And one issue is that these are difficult trials to recruit because to find that just that right patient population, which with high risk non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy is not easy. And so I think it'll be hard to do such trial, but it's very intriguing. I think again, promotes a lot of discussion about this topic and further research. And just in terms of the authors, and you know, this was the other thing is it's a closed system in Taiwan, so they have good follow-up. And I've actually been to this Changgong Eye Hospital. It's a very impressive place. It's right actually next to the Taiwan airport, and it's very impressive the things that they're doing down there.
Srizi, what are your thoughts? Are you convinced by this data? Like Dan, do you want to see more? And what do you else you kind of take in terms of the implications of this study?
One of the things that you know, I agree with Dan. One of the things that I thought was very interesting about the study, and they even mentioned this, they're not actually tracking lipids to see if lowering LDL is, you know, the factor here at play in terms of delaying onset and preventing progression of diabetic retinopathy. It's actually really all that they can say from this is starting the statin therapy versus a group of people that's not on statin. And they did a really good job of decreasing confounding by doing the control matching. And so in my opinion, you know, the first thing where my mind went was, is it the anti-inflammatory properties or some other, you know, reinforcement of endothelial function that the statins have been shown, you know, in terms of the cardiovascular literature that's helping these patients. I do think that, you know, with this many patients, the numbers are quite compelling. It was a 1.2% difference in terms of onset, but a significant, you know, if you go down the line, everything that they studied, really it did favor the group of patients that were receiving statins. In terms of how it alters practice, you know, one of the things that I always ask my diabetic patients, it's almost reflexively, I ask them, you know, how's their sugar doing, and obviously how's their blood pressure doing? Because we know there's a lot of good evidence to suggest that, you know, blood pressure does, or hypertension and uncontrolled hypertension exacerbates diabetic retinopathy. And I wonder if one of the things that I need to be asking patients more often now is also about their, you know, presence of dyslipidemia. And if so, if they're undergoing treatment. I agree with Dan. I'm unlikely to prescribe statins. You know, I've definitely had patients that are unable to tolerate them. But it may be something that you suggest to your patients or when you dictate letters to primary care physicians, that there is some evidence here that it could help. And, you know, I agree also that this is a good foundation for a, you know, well-constructed randomized controlled trial, which would be very difficult and expensive, but would be very valuable if these results that this paper are showing are indeed accurate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you guys both hit on some great points here. I think it's just fascinating, right? I think that, and I remember when Craig Revin came on, he talked about the ACCORD study, and it's something that we really haven't followed up and talked about. Maybe, Dan, you talked about study design. It's doable. It's a little tricky to design it and get a large enough base of patients to recruit to make it powerful and meaningful. But these are the types of studies you referenced earlier, right? Like these big data studies achieve things that randomized control studies can, and randomized control trials achieve things that these studies can't. And so kind of synthesizing all that together to know what's true and what isn't is really kind of the fascinating job we're all faced with. I'll just say, you know, one last thing before we break here, and I'll ask you guys a question. I mean, are you, Sriji, you talked about blood pressure, blood sugars. You know, lipids aren't necessarily something we check in, like you mentioned. Will this at least modify for Dan, for you? Are you going to be asking in your letters to PCPs, you know, for regular lipid panel? Is it going to change anything you do? I don't know if it would for me, but maybe it is something that I know we all have that smart phrase talking about blood sugar and blood pressure. Maybe this will be added at some point.
No, I think that's a great point, Jay. And I think these things definitely speak to, you know, are we really, you know, should we be doing this? And I think that's a great point. And I think we'll need to wait for further studies. And I think hopefully as more of these things come out and as we continue to evolve our practice guidelines, studies like these are now will be considered when, say, we come up with the next preferred practice patterns for diabetic retinopathy. It'll be, you know, it'd be a very interesting discussion in terms of what is our field consensus on statins or other lipid lowering agents.
Yeah, I mean, we will have to find out more as we go forward. Well, you know, I'm going to let you guys go. You guys were very patient with my long OR day, and you guys, thanks for doing this after hours. Sriji, welcome to the program. Thanks so much. And Dan, just before we go, you want to talk a little bit about this upcoming meeting in August, the American Retina Forum. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what that is and what the meeting will be about?
Yeah, absolutely. So just in disclosure, I don't have any financial interest in the American Retina Forum. I'm a participant and I'm helping organize the meeting. But I thought this is kind of a very interesting group. This was started by Mithil Mehta, one of our colleagues at UC Irvine, as well as Hemang Pandya, who's in private practice in Dallas. And essentially, it's from my understanding, it started as like a social media group, essentially a big WhatsApp group. It's now migrated to a Telegram application. And the idea is something like this. I think we all, as retina surgeons, we all have kind of questions. We want to run by things. And a lot of us have probably these informal kind of text message groups, perhaps from people from fellowship or residents, and say like, oh, hey, I have this interesting case. Like, how would you approach it? And it's nice to have that like kind of affirmation. Yeah, I would do the same thing or not, or any kind of random questions that we might have. And I think what this forum provides is that, but on steroids. So it's essentially, there's over 300 members, and these are predominantly all like young retina specialists. I think all of them within 10 years of within starting practice, the vast majority of them within 5 years of practice, and also a lot of fellows as well. And the idea and the vision that they had was to provide, you know, kind of a very safe educational environment for essentially for peer learning, where people would bring up either interesting patients to discuss, confounding diagnoses, or just questions about practice pattern, like, oh, how does your OR organize block time or after hours cases? And it's kind of probing the hive mind. So I would call it kind of like the Quora, if any of you guys are familiar with that application, Quori of
sure,
for like retina specialists. And so what's really nice is it's on an app. There's a Telegram app, and you can basically text in a question or whatever, and then people will respond in kind of this stream of consciousness thing. And the nice thing about it is that, you know, inevitably someone is on, and you will get like a few quick responses, like very quickly, like, probably within a matter of a couple of hours. And it's just really fascinating in terms of the conversations that go on. And I have to say, I've learned a ton from these discussions, because these are very, like, these are real scenarios, difficult questions, and it's just fascinating to kind of hear all the different perspectives. And so this is kind of this group, and I encourage everyone to join, especially the fellows. They can email Mithil Mehta. His email is mcmehta@uci.edu, or me to basically get on the program. But to cut it short, there's actually going to be a first inaugural meeting of this American Retina Forum. It's going to be in mid-August in Anaheim, very close to Disneyland. And the idea is kind of this, again, it's a very informal, casual meeting for people essentially to kind of get around and discuss issues of interest, and then also to build, I think, social community and networking. So there'll also be, I think a lot of my families are going, I'm going to bring my family to have time at the beach and go to Disneyland. And so it's a very informal, fun, and hopefully also very educational meeting for all. So I encourage all of you guys to register. I think the fellows registration is waived. I think there might even be a couple of fellow travel grants that we're trying to get. But I just wanted to spread the word about this.
So I'm going to say no financial disclosures for us or the podcast with them. Dan's just a friend and want to give him the opportunity to talk about it. And I will say this was expertly timed, Dan, because with the countries in the grip of polar vortex, Anaheim sounds pretty good to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Minus 50. I was just seeing something about
the hotel. It's...
Go ahead.
Oh yeah, it's right next to Disneyland. So this is actually right close to where I park if I usually end up going. So it's very convenient. And there's CME. So if you guys, it's a great, you know, family trip to Disneyland as well.
Srigi, anything to plug?
No, Disneyland sounds great. So I agree that having a forum for young retina specialists to bounce ideas off of, you know, you find that we all have a lot of the same questions, but sometimes there's not a good venue to really express them. And so I think this sounds great.
Well, guys, thank you so much for doing this. Thanks for your time. Again, the articles will be available in the episode description. Dan Chow, Srigi Patel, thanks so much. Have a great night.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
Thank you.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 152 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You will also find our blog, Equal, Round, and Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. We have this new feature where each episode that we release for the podcast, we get a blog post going along with some educational tidbits and giving some perspective from Mike Minacosta and Amy Klusterboer. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list. That will give you emails giving you the most recent episode updates. At the bottom, you can subscribe in Apple Podcast Store or on Google Play if you have an Android phone. You can like our Facebook page, and you are on Twitter at Retina Podcast. To contact us, there's multiple ways. You can click the Contact Us link on our website. You can email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback's great, and feedback gives us episode ideas, gives us ideas of how we can get better. And we appreciate anyone who subscribes in either the iTunes or Android store. If you leave your positive comments in the form of a review, it is much appreciated. Thanks to Dr. Daniel Chow and Dr. Srigi Patel for joining me today. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Minacosta, and Angela Chang for putting together this great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.